From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. On today's show, we're going to wait. We'll wait at doctor's offices.
Hey, how are you? Sorry I'm running behind schedule.
We'll sit with patients who are waiting for organs.
They go from an inability to do almost anything to a normal life afterwards. When patients are waiting, that's what we try to keep them focused on.
We'll spend time with scientists waiting for results.
And then we leave it there for about 24 hours, and we come back the next day, and we remove a sample.
We'll wait for elevators and for bananas to ripen.
That means it'll come in green as grass, and when we're ready to send it out, it'll be like half yellow, half green.
We're going to do all these wonderful things, but you're going to have to wait. The news.
All of our representatives are busy assisting other customers. Please hold for the next available representative. Thank you for your patience.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse will walk on ice and wrestle with invasive snails to understand the latest scientific developments.
Injuries to the brain due to experience.
The same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
There are things that you do that influence your friends, friends, friends.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Robots are really just computers with motors.
I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
The relationship doesn't seem selection right. And
did you feel a lot of happiness?
I'm just giving you some of the medicine for your IV.
There's any point here.
What happened to you?
Today's show is all about waiting. We'll wait with scientists in their labs staring into a ball jar filled with moss. We'll wait for elevators and for bananas to ripen. And we'll sit with a patient waiting for a kidney. First up on our list, the places where we wait as patients. There is, of course, the doctor's office waiting room, sitting there waiting for your name to be called, reading 10 tips to make better rice pudding or 5 ways to achieve amazing abs. It can get really aggravating. What's the holdup? What are they doing on the other side of that door? I wanted to find out, so I decided to spend a morning with Dr. Peter Gearhart of Penn OBGYN and Midwifery Care.
I gotta go. We're gonna be late.
At 8 o'clock on a recent Monday morning, Gearhart is trying to get 3 little dogs and one of his 3 sons out the door.
Mega!
On his way to his practice, Gearhart drops the dogs off at his wife's office, drops his son off at school. Then he gets a call from Pennsylvania Hospital. A patient he operated on the previous week is ready for discharge. They want to know if he wants to see her before she leaves. He dictates a text message into his phone while walking.
Yes, she can go home. However, I won't be able to see her until the afternoon because I am in the office this morning. If she wants to see me, she'll have to wait.
Moments later, he changes his mind.
We should see her. The problem is I didn't really get to see her over the weekend, and it's kind of not cool to not see her before she goes home. You don't want to just hear from some random person that everything's fine and you're okay. You want to hear it from the surgeon that operated on you.
He races into the hospital, sees his patient, and minutes later is back on his way toward his practice. He arrives there a few minutes late. He has patients scheduled from 8:45 to 4:15.
So this is my 9 o'clock patient I'm going to see first, is that right? Okay, so I'll see my 9 o'clock patient, and then I'll see my 8:45 patient who just got here. Okay, great.
He's seeing his second patient first because his first patient was late.
Katrina Drake is the lead medical assistant in the practice. She weighs patients, takes their blood pressure, goes over their medical issues, and she keeps Gearhart on track and patients flowing in and out of 5 different exam rooms. She's constantly checking a computer screen where different colored dots tell her where patients are.
Is it kind of like playing Tetris where...
It is absolutely like playing Tetris. I'm constantly refreshing the screen, looking at his schedule, and a 5-minute visit could turn into a 20-minute visit, or what you think is a 20-minute visit could actually be a 5-minute visit. So it's kind of hard to gauge, but you just go patient by patient.
Gerhard comes out of one of the exam rooms. So far, he's pretty much on time.
So you've seen two patients so far?
I've seen three people so far.
Three?
Yeah.
How did you do that? I only saw you see two.
I don't know. You just have to be quick.
At her computer screen, Katrina Drake is trying to deal with a problem. A pregnant patient who came in for a so-called non-stress test that monitors the baby's heart rate is not getting a good reading.
We moved her over to the ultrasound machine.
So that could tack another 5 to 10 minutes onto the visit. As of right now, Gerhard is only about 15 minutes behind, but that's because two patients haven't shown up yet.
So if they show up, then we'll have a different story.
It's always a good thing, bad thing when there's a cancellation because it helps catch up the schedule. On the other hand, it means somebody's not getting seen and they probably have some kind of an issue.
But then the late patients walk in. One is 45 minutes late, the other 30 minutes. So the schedule is completely off. The practice does not turn away late patients. They just might get bumped or they have to wait, but it causes problems.
I mean, if you're a patient coming in and you're waiting, you don't know that the person who's ahead of you was 45 minutes late. All you know is that you were on time.
Gerhard races from room to room trying to catch up.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Then another problem arises that will throw off the schedule further.
So I just saw a patient who's here for a routine screening visit, and she has some problems that we have discovered today. She's going to require a minor surgery in order to deal with those problems, and I am forced to either tell her to come back so we can deal with that, or I can deal with it now. I can answer her questions and set up, schedule the surgery and all of that sort of thing.
He opts to deal with the issue now.
You know, it's a real problem now for the patient, and for me to tell her that I don't have time to deal with it is incredibly insensitive.
So what do you need to get forms?
I have to go pee. Which, yeah, I have to go get paperwork, so she's getting dressed. I'm now officially behind schedule.
Hey, how are you? Sorry I'm running behind schedule.
Gerhard was supposed to take a lunch break around noon, but Drake knows that won't happen.
He is still finishing out with his 11:30 and it's now 12:12.
By 12:30, he's seen 18 patients. He steps into his office for 5 minutes to wolf down his lunch, portable food as he calls it.
It's a burrito wrap with whatever was left over from dinner thrown in there.
He says a day in the office is the hardest part of his job, harder than a difficult birth or any operation.
In the office, your brain is constantly trying to think about 3 or 4 different things at once while making sure that you slow down enough to look at the patient in the eye, hold her hand if she needs it, listen. Listening is very important.
So why doesn't he just schedule fewer patients in a day? He says it's not an option.
Who would see those other patients? All of my colleagues are equally busy. And what we're seeing with expanded access to healthcare is there's even more patients waiting in line to be seen.
And with that, lunch is pretty much over.
This is my third bite. I'm going to have one more right now, and then I'll save the rest for later.
And it's on to round two. The afternoon patients.
Hello. How are you?
It was a long wait time, you know.
Sitting in a waiting room, drag as it is only half the battle. First, you need an appointment. Not always easy.
To make, change, or cancel an appointment, please press 2.
For this next story, we go to Trenton, where a health group is trying to schedule people more quickly. It used to take more than a month for patients to get in. Now, it's down to about 2 days. How did they do this? We sent the Pulse's Alana Gordon to find out.
This is the part of a health clinic you may never see, and why would you?
Thank you for calling MJ Austin. How can I help you?
It's the call center here at Henry J. Austin, a community health clinic in Trenton. The clinic's four locations are main points of entry for healthcare in a city where at least a third of people live below the poverty level. The clinic alone handles more than 50,000 patient visits a year.
Okay, I do have 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2:30, and 3 o'clock.
Manuel Soto is one of several people facing the flood of calls each morning.
Time goes by quick. Next thing you know, it's time to go home, so it's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty exciting, though. Busy, though, yeah.
Soto says this call center can easily book 100 appointments in a day. But get this, most are for that same day, the next day, or within a week. It's methodical, but it wasn't always this way.
Deliver the motion every 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that means you even have to wake up at night.
Dr. Kemi Ali is the medical director at Henry J. Austin and has been leading the charge here and throughout all of Trenton to reduce wait times for primary care visits. She says it used to take, on average, more than a month for people to get in for an appointment.
It was just difficult.
For everyone, staff and patients.
The theme that you would hear is, you know, frustration or stress in the patient trying to get in and be seen. And then, you know, that snowballs and can lead to many different things. It leads to higher ER visits. It leads to, you know, if you don't go to the ER and you just don't get the services you need, then you end up in the hospital. So just the snowball effect of all the things that we know that we don't want from healthcare.
Ali says staff had trouble keeping up, and yet the clinic's packed schedule included no-shows 40% of the time.
I thought there has to be a better way to do this, you know, do this, all of this.
Enter Mark Murray.
I'm a physician who's worked for the last 20 years solely on building and designing systems that get patients into their own doctors without waiting.
Ali called him for help. He'd heard these concerns before.
Common complaints, you know, a system that's out of control.
Murray preaches a concept called advanced access, or open access, that's gained a lot of traction in recent years. Companies like Starbucks and Amazon often use this thinking to reduce waiting. Murray says, why not apply it to healthcare? Supply and demand levels, even at places like Henry J. Austin, may be more predictable than you think. If there's a constant 3-month appointment delay, then...
What that means is that you have enough capacity to keep up, but you've chosen to design a system that won't keep up. So why do you make everybody wait 3 months? 20 people call, they get put at the end of the line 3 months from now. Well, get rid of that 3 months of backlog, 20 people call, see them today.
That's the basic concept. Understanding supply and demand requires constant data crunching. Dr. Ali was on board, but convincing staff to let go of the old system wasn't an easy sell, especially because it meant 6 months of working longer days and seeing additional patients to get rid of that pent-up backlog. Kimberly Allen, a nurse, remembers that transition.
One thing that really helped is that we started morning huddle meetings. So we had this 15 minutes where we kind of like, you know, encouraged one another and said, okay, this is what we have. This is our picture for the day, and let's do it. And this is how we're going to get it done.
It's been about 2 years since they threw away the old scattered scheduling system. Today, Dr. Ali says the goal is getting patients in within 2 days. Sometimes it's less, sometimes more. Returning patients see the same doctor. The new appointment system has also cut down on those no-shows because patients are getting in sooner. Over in the patient area, I asked some people about their experience. Ethel McCurry came in with a friend, but her leg has been bothering her.
They're going to see me Wednesday.
I think that's good.
It took no time at all. No time at all.
Charles Carter is another patient. He first came to the clinic a few weeks ago. Others say it's still a challenge getting in to see their doctor. Alanya Tootle says it's hard getting through the call center during that morning rush. Slots fill fast.
And then they say, well, we don't have anything for this month, but you got to call back by next week, Monday at 8 o'clock to see if we got something. That's the problem.
Dr. Ali says the system isn't perfect, but they're keeping tabs daily.
I would say we're about 3/4 where I'd like us to be, where I think we really need to be. And part of that is improving the flow within the practice. I think there's still work to be done there.
She says making a more responsive call center and scheduling system is important. But one continuing challenge is they don't have enough staff or space to respond to the many residents needing care in Trenton, meaning the clinic doesn't have the supply to meet the overall demand. Ali says addressing that involves a broader strategy, one that extends well beyond these clinic doors. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You know you're going to have to wait when you go to the ER. In fact, I recently thought I might be dying, and I said to my husband, I think I should go to the ER. And he said, what, you want to wait for 5 hours? Long wait times are, in fact, one of the biggest complaints people have about the ER experience. We talked to Dr. Karl Chudnovsky, chair of emergency medicine for Einstein Healthcare Network, about strategies they use to keep things moving.
We have an area that we call fast track, and it's an area that we take care of lower acuity patients, individuals with complaints that aren't life or limb threatening. For people who don't need lots of lab tests and lots of x-rays, it's an area that we can get them seen quickly by a clinician and then get them the treatment they need and discharged as quickly as possible. We actually have another area besides the fast track. We call it mini clinic. And it's for patients who have even lower acuity problems, problems that could be seen in a chair rather than having to lie in a bed. And it allows us to get people seen quickly who don't need to lie down. And our goal for patients who are seen in that area is to be in and out in 90 minutes. And generally, we hit that goal most days. Not every day, but most days.
Karl Chudnovsky heads Einstein's emergency medicine department. Kenya Eubanks is a nurse there. She talks fast and moves fast, getting critical patients the care they need and steering non-urgent cases in and out quickly. She's one of the people responsible for multi-level triage that deals with everything from stroke to sore throats. But she says her listening skills are just as important as her medical skills.
Have you ever heard of organized chaos? So that's what we try to do. We take care of patients from newborns all the way up to geriatric patients.
Well, that's pretty normal. Have you been pregnant before?
I call us the frontline angels. We are the frontline because for this particular community, a lot of them come in through the emergency department. We're getting the patients when they're vulnerable and they do not know what's going on and they're scared. They're angry and they're stressed and they're bringing whatever issues that they have from the outside into here also. They may or may not be sick, but they don't know this. And we have to give them a sense of comfort. We have to give them a sense of, if you were my mother, then this is what I would do for her. In order to work in an emergency department, you truly have to like people. You have to genuinely listen. And if you let them vent and they can get it off their chest, and then you say, I hear what you're saying, and I truly do understand what you're saying. So this is what I'm going to try to do to help you. And if you can help me help you, then we can work together. Sometimes we do get full. So then if I had a hallway bed, I'm going to put you into a hallway bed maybe. But you have to remember that this is an emergency department. Not that you're not sick, but we have people that are sicker than you. Then we have to go accordingly. While you're waiting, would you like the television? Would you like to listen to the music? I can get you some crackers and juice while you're sitting here waiting. And I'll come back and I'll check on them. I'll talk to them about little personal things just to keep them occupied so they're not bored, because I think it's the boredom that kills people from waiting. A lot of times if somebody's angry about waiting, then there is an underlying issue. But if you can understand that there is an underlying issue and that they're not angry at you, that there is something else going on, then you can continue functioning and helping that person.
Kenya Eubanks is a nurse at Einstein's Emergency Medicine Department. Jeanette Woods produced this segment. The way waiting rooms look also has an impact on how people deal with wait times. Jennifer Mishkin has designed waiting rooms for hospitals and medical offices, and she lets us in on a few design secrets.
So for good designs in waiting rooms, you have natural daylight, views to nature, artwork, particularly showing nature, nice materials, woods, comforting colors, and a flow that allows people to move very easily between check-in, check-out, and going for their appointments.
And she says we as patients are actually getting more say in how things look.
Partially because of the competitive nature, especially here in the Philadelphia region, of health systems, and that you want patients to come back, you want them to like your facility. There is also surveys that are done to find out what people thought of the environment and the staff and the care that they've received. And so people are recognizing that the physical built environment sort of sets the stage for the health care that's being given.
That's Jennifer Mishkin. She is Associate Director of Interiors at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine, and she used to design waiting rooms for hospitals and medical offices. And we have a lot more of her design ideas on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up on The Pulse, waiting for a new life hooked to a machine.
Seems like you're there forever, unless TNT has a good movie on. The last hour seemed like it never gonna come.
That's next here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
I am waiting. I am waiting.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Michael Scott. Today's show is all about waiting.
I'm not special. I'm just another patient that, you know, wait for my turn.
About 6,000 people in the Philadelphia region need an organ transplant. The network of doctors, nurses, and family members who wait with them is even larger. Tanya English spent time with some of them.
The wait for a transplant organ can stretch out for years, but when an organ finally does become available, it needs to find a new home fast. A kidney might last 24 hours after a donor dies, a liver 8 hours. A lung or heart needs to be transplanted within 4. When a donor heart matches a patient at Temple University Hospital, it's nurse Liz Kerr who gets the call.
Typically, it's very late at night for the most part, so my phone is always charged up.
When Kerr's ringtone starts chiming, it's news for someone she knows personally.
It's never a bother. Here's the funny thing. I said it that it sounds like Christmas morning. And I purposely made it something joyous that it would be a happy moment, and it is.
Depending on the organ, how long you wait, where you wait is different. Newer drugs, better medicines, let most heart patients do their time at home. Temple University cardiologist Renee Alvarez says that wasn't the rule 10 years ago.
They would have a wing in the hospital that was dedicated to patients awaiting transplantation, and literally they would live here for 6 to 9 months.
These days, medical staffers monitor patients using cell phones and a suite of implanted mini devices that assist an ailing heart or give it a kickstart if there's a problem.
It's like having a portable emergency room in your chest.
Heart size matters and blood type all factor into the wait time. But Alvarez says in this region, most heart failure patients get a transplant in about 3 months.
They go from an inability to do almost anything to a normal life afterwards. When patients are waiting, that's what we try to keep them focused on.
Lori Smith's husband needs a liver.
His name is Rowling Smith. We've been together for 31 years. Started seeing each other in 1983. He happened to be my softball coach.
For 5 weeks, Rowling has been at Hahnemann Hospital, unable to leave his bed. For 7 or 8 hours each day, Lori is with him.
You're on automatic pilot. I know, this is right now, this is my life. Get up, work out, go to the hospital, spend the day, ask questions, come home, have something to eat, and go to bed.
Smith's real bed is 130 miles away, back home in Lackawanna County, where she's a dental hygienist.
I actually got fired because I wouldn't leave my husband in ICU to go home and clean teeth. You know, he needs me more than I need that job.
After her day at the hospital in Philadelphia, Lori comes back to the Gift of Life family house. The rooms are cheap, just $40 a night.
Sweet peppers, onions, Caesar salad.
Parking is free. There's a hot cooked meal at 6 and company.
You know, you feel so all alone. But then when you finally sit down and start talking to someone, it's like, oh, wow, you know, they're going through the same thing I'm going through.
The vast majority of people who need an organ need a kidney. Their wait time is the longest. Here's one story.
Okay, my name is Edward Spiller. I'm 61 years old, and I'm waiting on a kidney.
Neighbors, nurses, just about everyone calls him Mr. Spiller. There were early signs that he was very sick, but Mr. Spiller didn't take much notice until his symptoms kept him from going to work. One morning, his feet were swollen.
Oh, elephant feet. The shoes I had on had spread it all the way open. You know, the shoestrings wouldn't hold it together.
When kidneys stop working, fluid gets trapped in the body. Mr. Spiller had been diagnosed with diabetes 10 years earlier. And this time, the doctor said the disease had done permanent damage.
And they came and said, Mr. Spiller, your kidney failed. Both of them. They told me that I would have to start going to dialysis. That was September the 18th, 06.
Since then, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he sits while a machine filters his blood. At first, no one even talks about how soon you'll get a kidney.
Some people be on dialysis 10 years, 8 years, 2 years, 3 years.
This is Mr. Spiller's job now, watching Jerry Springer or fishing shows, biding his time at dialysis. Each session lasts about 5 hours.
Seems like you're there forever, unless TNT has a good movie on. The last hour seems like it's never going to come.
The clinic has 16 chairs. For 3 shifts a day, every seat is filled.
That's 48 people in there, 6 days a week. I'm not special. I'm just another patient, you know, wait for my turn.
How do you measure that time?
Hard. We become a family in there. You got the one brother, Grouchy. You got the aunt that's evil to everybody. You watch some die. You watch some give up, then you watch some fight forever.
Before this year, Mr. Spiller had never gotten a call. Then suddenly, in the last month, there have been 10 near misses. Sometimes the organ was a match, but every time the kidney went to someone higher on the list. That's hard, too.
But then I remember, I'm the one that ate all the cheeseburgers and the steaks. I'm the one that didn't go to the doctor and take care of myself. And you accept that reality.
So usually, his cell phone is on.
When I'm in church, I cut my phone off. I don't even put it on vibrate. And if it meant for me to get a kidney, the Lord gonna make sure I'm there on time to get it.
And we're going to have an update on Mr. Spiller in a little while, so you're gonna have to wait for that. But Tanya, in the meantime, I did want to ask you some questions about this wait list that people are on. How does it work?
Okay, so there are actually different wait lists, kind of depending on what organ you need. But in general, the rules are set up so that the organs go to the sickest patients first.
Last year, there was a controversial case right here in this region that had a lot of public attention, a lot of social media attention.
Yeah, so the case you're remembering is 10-year-old Sarah Murnahan. She has cystic fibrosis and she needed new lungs. Her parents successfully sued to get Sarah placed at the top of the adult lung transplant list, and that made lots of people angry. Howard Nathan is president of the Gift of Life Donor Program, which coordinates organ transplantation for our region.
I've been in this 36 years. That's not the way I would see us running a system. You just wouldn't want to see that every single person tries to do a public relations campaign to get the organ. That's just not fair.
So there was an exception made for Sarah Murnahan, but actually the underlying policy, which is called the under 12 rule, did not change. Typically, it takes up to 2 years to first test and then change a transplant policy. And there's always lots of debate among surgeons, among patients, and donor families.
So there's this huge mismatch between demand and supply of organs. Is anything happening in that realm?
Yeah, so the Gift of Life does lots of grassroots education to change perceptions, but Howard Nathan says many people just don't trust the medical system.
You know, one of the biggest fears that people have is that they're going to go to a hospital, and if they sign up to be an organ donor on their driver's license, oh, someone, doctor's going to see that, and they're not going to take care of me. And, you know, it's so far from the truth.
So donor consent is typically very low among African Americans. The sign-up rate is only about 31% in Philadelphia, where the black population is large. By contrast, the sign-up rate is nearly twice as high in surrounding Montgomery and Chester counties.
So are there any fixes for the situation on the horizon?
There are some ideas. One idea that comes up a lot is to switch to an opt-out donor system. So that means that we would presume that people want to be an organ donor when they go get their driver's license or state ID, unless that person explicitly says that they don't want to be a donor. So the opt-out system has increased the number of available organs in Spain, for example, but it's actually that idea has never really caught on here in the United States. They tried it in Delaware, they tried it in Pennsylvania. It got a lot of pushback, and it never cleared the state house.
Any other ideas?
Okay, so another idea is to encourage more living donation. So instead of waiting for an accident or an aneurysm for someone to be brain dead, the transplant would come from a living person. So live donation is possible for a full kidney, part of a liver, or part of a lung.
And that could be a family member or anybody who's a match.
They would still have to figure out who's the best kind of closest match, but it could come from anyone.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
Talking about waiting on this edition of The Pulse. What if you could speed up the waiting process? Well, in some cases you can. For example, a perfectly ripened banana. For one of the nation's biggest banana wholesalers, this is an exact science. Millions of bananas pass through the Philadelphia wholesale produce market near the airport. They flow in on boats from Central and South America and wait there for a few days before getting to grocery stores across the eastern seaboard. Zach Seward went to the ripening room and he sent back this postcard from the banana desk.
We ripen about 35,000 boxes a week. Multiply that times 40 pounds and whatever that comes out to, it's a lot of bananas. I'm Mark Levin. I'm with M. Levin & Company Incorporated in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We are banana wholesalers and jobbers, as well as a full line of fruits and vegetables from around the world. Once the bananas arrive here, they are here anywhere from 3.5 to 7 days. We have a ripening cycle generally at around 4 to 5 days. That means it'll come in green as grass, and when we're ready to send it out, it'll be like half color, half yellow, half green.
Come on, Matt.
I'm separating these dough bags. They're going in the air.
Boom, she's in there. 28 feet.
There'll be 3 dough bags, 1 dough bag in the middle, 2 quads, 2 petites on the ground. So they're easy to get to, whatever ones you want first. You don't want to bury nothing. Have everything available for the top rack.
The humidity makes the bananas a brighter color. I'm David Levin, and I ripen the bananas at M. Levin & Company. I've been doing this for 37 years. My grandfather started the business 108 years ago. You're paying close attention all the time to how they're ripening. I may expect them to ripen one way, and they are very stubborn and don't ripen that way. So, yes, I have to wait for them. Banana ripening is a chemical process. It gives off heat. It's necessary to draw the heat out. Ethylene gas is just a catalyst to help the bananas ripen. Citrus gives off ethylene gas. It's a natural gas, but they introduce it in the atmosphere to make all the bananas in this room ripen evenly.
These rooms are operated strictly by computer, and where there's a computer, there's always a remote. And although my father would turn over in his grave if he knew we weren't looking at the bananas, because nobody ripens bananas unless they're being looked at, yes, you can do it. We don't. We still believe our eyes.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and we want to go home.
Day, is a day, oh.
Coming up on The Pulse, waiting doesn't have to be a bad thing.
I remember that I was starting to wait and anticipate about what it would be like, who it would be with, trying to keep my body from pushing me into ending my year prematurely.
One woman shares the details of her 12-month experiment in abstinence. That's next here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about waiting today, and that's something scientists do a lot of. Waiting for a fungus to grow, waiting for measurements to go up, to go down, for some minute tiny detail to change. Two Villanova University researchers recently took us into their lab for a glimpse at their process and the time it takes to get results. Laura Benchoff has this story.
Hi, I'm Kel Weider. I'm a professor of biology at Villanova University. I am an ecosystem ecologist, or the fancy word is a biogeochemist.
Weider and his colleague, Professor Melanie Weil, study the impact of increased nitrogen on Alberta's peatlands. Trucks and refineries emit nitrogen in the process of producing consumable energy from oil sands.
So each individual plant is really, really tiny, but on a global scale, sphagnum, the genus of moss that forms peat, is probably more important than any other plant.
That's a big claim, and here's the argument behind it. Peat does a really good job of storing carbon, making it an important player in the global carbon balance. Weider and Weil think that nitrogen pollution disrupts and may someday reverse peat's stabilizing role in our climate. And they're testing that hypothesis in the lab.
To actually answer the question, what will nitrogen do to the peatlands, we could sit around and wait for 10 years, or we could find a very clean site and manipulate the system.
This involves spraying nitrogen on control sites around Alberta, and then carefully sampling and recording the ecosystem response.
We use these basic canning jars that you would use to preserve jellies and jams and all kinds of things. We put the mosses in the jar, and then we put them in upside down, so the green living part is actually facing the sun, and we put the whole jar back into the peat. And then we leave it there for about 24 hours, and we come back the next day, and we remove a sample using a syringe.
From May to October, their team spends long days in northern Alberta, driving from field site to field site, collecting thousands of samples. Back at Villanova, Weider and Weil spend months crunching numbers and charting data, and it's a slow process. Using computer-automated equipment speeds up some of the data collection. Weider and Weil can now process 300 samples a day mechanically versus 50 samples a day by hand, and that's good because they're on the clock. As slow and methodical as this research is, there are people waiting for results.
The goal is were charged with our funding to come up with an answer. And so usually that time frame is within 3 to 5 years.
And they have documented some support for their hypothesis.
So we just completed our third season, and we're already starting to see a shrub response.
So if shrubs thrive in the newly nitrogen-rich environment, they may start to shade out the low-growing mosses. But documenting that response will take even more time, more fieldwork, and more samples. Years that could feel like an eternity waiting for results. But for these scientists...
we happen to love our work, so ideally I could see me working in these systems forever.
For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Sometimes when you're in a hurry, waiting for an elevator can feel like an eternity. And pushing the button a few extra times just doesn't do a thing. Why is that elevator up on the fourth floor and not here? There's actual, serious science guiding this path. Teresa Christie is a mathematician and Otis Elevator Research Fellow. She optimizes elevator runs for a living. And I asked her, what's the ideal wait time once you've pushed that button?
Basically, we try to aim for an average of 20 seconds if you're in a grade A office building. If you're in a residential building, that average is a little longer. And that's because, traditionally speaking, people in residential buildings are more relaxed. They'll wait a little bit longer before they get frustrated or feel that the elevator isn't coming.
Is there a formula that tells you, okay, if the building is this size with this many people in it, here's how many elevators you're going to need?
Well, that's a tricky question. The answer is yes and no. There is a formula that will help guide you to that direction. But the formula, which has been in existence for a long time, is called the round trip time. And it goes with something called handling capacity. It's a probability formula. It's based off of statistics. And it gives you an idea, on average, what percent of the building population you can handle with how many elevators. So if you tell me there's 1,000 people in the building and I'm looking for a 12% handling capacity, then I need to have 120 people being moved every 5 minutes. I need to have enough elevators to do that. And I can work that out with a formula. But the problem is that those formulas are generalized. And nowadays we have something new. It's called destination dispatching. And now people are no longer just pressing an up button or a down button. They're actually using a keypad or a touch screen, and they're putting in their destination. So instead of just saying up, they're going to put 7. And then that little device is going to come back to them and say, okay, you wait for car A. Now, doing this allows us to group people by destination. It lowers the number of stops on average that a person would make, but it also renders our tried and true formulas no longer valid.
Might that mean you will need fewer elevators because they will move more quickly, more streamlined?
Yes. That is the holy grail of elevator dispatchers, that we can use fewer elevators and handle the same people.
The kind of math you do to figure out the questions of elevators, is that applicable in other fields? Do you share your findings with other fields?
We do share, but we don't share the exact formulas that we use or the exact methodology. And that's because elevator companies consider their dispatching to be kind of like a cook's favorite recipe that they're known for and that only they can make. And they don't want to give it out because then anybody could make it. So the actual, you know, nitty-gritty of a lot of things is kept secret.
What are some of the fields that you have learned something from?
Well, we basically like to look at transportation, whether it's buses, trains, whether it's delivering packages like UPS or FedEx, and also things like network and how packages are going. When I say packages here, I'm meaning packets of electronic data, how they're moving over the networks and how they're routed to get them to the best place. The problem that we have when we read all of this information or we speak with these people and we learn is that packages don't mind going past their destination and then being brought back to it. neither do electronic bits, but people do. So there have been some dispatching algorithms for elevators proposed where, you know, you get in and you tell the elevator you want to go to floor 3, and it might bring you first to floor 5 and then turn around and bring you back to floor 3. Well, elevator companies tend not to do that. People don't like it, and it's become sort of an unwritten rule that a dispatching algorithm won't do that, even if we might get a little bit better performance overall.
The human element must play a big role anyway in what you do, because sometimes even if the wait is short, but if I'm late for a meeting, then the wait feels really long to me. If I'm having a great conversation with, you know, some nice guy who works next door, then the wait is not that long.
Absolutely. And that's something that we call perceived waiting time. With the destination systems, if I tell you that the car that's coming for you is car A, you will have a tendency to walk over to car A and stand somewhat in front of it, maybe not directly in front of it so that you don't bump into people when they're getting off the car, but over in that general direction. Whereas if you didn't know which car was coming for you, you might just stand in the middle and you might just kind of wait and then have to move when one of the cars comes and opens its doors. Well, that walking time, that time that you've spent coming from the destination entry device over towards your elevator, that's a time that, yeah, it might only be a few seconds, but you're doing something. And you've already got this idea that I know which car is coming, the system's got me registered. It tends that people are willing to wait a little bit longer because they don't really realize they're waiting a little bit longer. The other thing that we've found is that when people are distracted, and the classic example that is used over and over is when there's mirrors in the elevator lobby. People are looking at themselves. They might be combing their hair, adjusting their skirt, whatever. They also tend not to notice quite so much. But you're also correct in what you say about, you know, it depends on circumstances. We are a global company, and we've noticed that there's a little bit of a geographic difference as well. Our customers in Japan, for example, are always asking us, can we please work to make everybody have the same wait time, even if it's longer? So they would like it if maybe nobody ever waited 10 seconds or 15 seconds and everybody waited 30 seconds. That would be okay with them. Whereas in New York City, where we have a lot of corporate heads and executive managers, they're always in the idea that the most important people, which are usually located on the highest floors or higher floors, they should have the shortest because they're the most important. So they're always asking us, can we come up with some way that people on this floor wait less than people on other floors? So there is a cultural norm to that.
Teresa Christie is a mathematician and an Otis Elevator Research Fellow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megan.
Waiting can be a good thing. It can teach impulse control and lessons about what we really want and why we want it. Lynn Myers Jovanovich is a professor of psychology at California State University. She's a sex researcher and a therapist. And some years ago, she decided to forego sex for 12 months. Here, she reflects on her year of abstinence.
What led me to make the decision to stop having sex for a year was a very bad breakup, and sex being so powerful to me and so such a driving force felt like something I needed to examine away from the way my physical body wanted me to do it, and that needed me to stop. At the beginning, because of everything that was going on for me, I didn't miss sex. I didn't long for it. I didn't have to wait for it. But as that year went on and as things in my life changed and I came close to maybe the 9 or 10 month point, I remember that I was starting to wait and anticipate about what it would be like, who it would be with, trying to keep my body from pushing me into ending my year prematurely. But when that year was up, nothing had changed about the pleasure of sex. It was beautiful and wonderful and powerful and exciting. It just changed my perception of where it fit into my life.
That's psychologist Lynn Myers Jovanovich talking about a year of abstinence.
you, baby. Sometime I want.
And as promised, we have an update on an earlier story. Remember 61-year-old Edward Spiller? He's lived for more than 7 years on dialysis. Well, Mr. Spiller got a kidney. We sent Tanya English to Einstein Medical Center to check on him.
It's 4 days after surgery. Mr. Spiller is propped up in bed, connected to a bunch of wires, but smiling.
And I'm sore as hell, but I'll be all right.
A newly transplanted organ can be sluggish at first, but this kidney is already working fine. Patients aren't told much about the organ donor, but Mr. Spiller's new kidney comes from a woman in her 40s who died after an asthma attack. He's grateful, but realized he was waiting for a lot more than a kidney.
You know, freedom. Travel with my brother. He'd be able to travel with him. Maybe we get to go to Canada and do some salmon fishing.
He still has to take a lot of medicine to keep this kidney healthy, but Mr. Spiller gets to leave his dialysis chair behind.
That's a blessing, but it won't be empty that long.
As of Tuesday this week, 5,338 other people in the Philadelphia region are waiting for a kidney.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the assistant producer. Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Krista Tullo is our vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. And wait, I'm Mike and Scott. Thanks for listening.